I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Nineteen years ago today, 13 people died in a shooting at Columbine High School. As the debate over gun control continues, some activists are asking, has anything changed in the last two decades? That's one of the questions we'll put to students participating in today's National School Walkout over gun regulation. We'll ask what they want to see happen to make their schools safer. Then, the legacy of Jane Austen. More than 200 years after her death, her novels, such as Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, continue to attract fans. We'll meet a Janiac and find out why readers are still so devoted to her writing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, here they come again. Students across the nation this morning are once again protesting gun violence. One rally in Kansas City takes place in about 20 minutes in Hyde Park at 3619 Gillum Road in Kansas City. This all comes after that horrendous Valentine's Day shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School down in Parkland, Florida. Today also happens to be the 19th anniversary of the 1999 Columbine High School mass shooting in Littleton, Colorado. Here to talk about today's events and just what it's all about, that these students, just what it is that these students hope to achieve, are Jay Mehta. He's a junior from Pembroke Hill. He joins us by phone from the rally site. He's one of the organizers for today's event. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Kraske. It's a pleasure to be back on.
Caroline Bennett's also with me here in the studio. She's also an organizer. She's from Park Hill South High School in Riverside, where she's a sophomore. Caroline, nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
Peter Gaddo is a senior from Pembroke Hill who's participating in today's rally. Peter, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
And also here, Lauren Washington is a Pembroke senior and another participant for today's rally. Lauren, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Jay, let me come to you. What's happening in Hyde Park today? Well, maybe we just lost Jay. Let me go to Caroline here. What's happening in Hyde Park?
Well, today in Hyde Park, we are gathering to rally to further our movement to look for common sense gun laws.
And how many schools are involved? Do you have an idea in how
yes.
many students you expect today?
Our permit is for 500 students, and as of today, we have 10 schools participating.
Do you think you'll get 500 students?
I think we'll get 500 students, easy.
You know, I'm wondering how your schools are handling your absences from class today. What are you hearing about that, Lauren?
Yes, at Pembroke Hill, we all had to turn in forms, get all of our teachers to sign off on that, and our parents' signatures. And so we all just had to check in. And those with sports, they have a two-hour time allotted. And so we just had to get that cleared. But everyone's been very supportive of us.
Are you missing the entire day?
No, I'm missing just about a couple, 2 to 3 hours, and I'll be back for my last class.
Peter, do you have any hassle?
No, I didn't. The only issue I had is that I had a track meet, so I'm missing the rest of the day, too. But yeah. All the teachers seem to be pretty supportive of it.
Yeah, same thing at your high school, Caroline, Park Hill South?
The teachers, I think, are supportive. They can't outwardly say that they support us, but we had to fill out permission forms to get our parents to sign off to let us go.
But they're winking at you and letting you know maybe that they think this is a good thing you're doing.
Yes, although they can't technically have us opinion on it because then it's not fair.
Yeah. Jay Mehta, how big a deal is this rally today? Are you there, Jay? Hey, Jay, are you there? Okay, we'll try it again later. So what are you guys hoping to achieve today, Lauren? What's the hope here?
For me personally, it's been great seeing a lot of my classmates step up and organize this event. So I want to be there to support them and hopefully document the experience and take some photos there. And just to be able to use my voice as a student and, soon to be college student, hopefully to, enact change and, come together.
Peter, so what's got you guys in a rallying kind of spirit here? Was it the shooting down in Parkland, Florida? Has it been a culmination of things? Why are you guys as active as you are on this issue all of a sudden?
I think it's definitely been a culmination of issues because we've been seeing these events happening, you know, all the way since 1999 and even before. So that's
But there hasn't been a response since the Parkland shooting.
Yeah, so it's just, I think a big part of it is how social media has become such a large force, because before we'd only hear about these things from the news, but now we get to see the voices of the students in a very real way in the way that we interact with our friends.
Caroline, social media is a big deal right now, and it's helping rally all the students who are showing up in Gillen Park today, right?
Oh, definitely. Our movement is completely propelled by social media. In 1968, I believe, there was a walkout at Lincoln Preparatory School where it was for civil rights. And today, they only had, like, call phones then. And today, we're able to access thousands of more people than we could have with just the call phones. I mean, tons and tons of people are able to understand what our message is and rally with us because we're able to communicate with them.
Okay, I'm going to try Jay Mehta one more time here, again from Pembroke Hill. He's one of the organizers for today's rally. Jay, do I have you?
Yes, you do.
This is your last shot, Jay. If it didn't work this time, I was going to cut you forever, you know?
Oh, man, I would have been so sad.
All right, how big a deal is today's rally, Jay?
Today is a very, very big deal, Mr. Kraske. You know, I think it's rare that people really utilize the power of coming together and I think a lot of people think of people our age as being unengaged. They think about us as being uninterested and apathetic. And I think what you're about to see today, not just here, but around the country, is going to prove that wrong. I think it's going to be really amazing.
We were just talking while we were trying to get you back on the line here. What is it that has galvanized young people to the extent they've been galvanized in recent weeks? What's happened? Because as of 6 months ago, there wasn't much movement out there on anything.
Yeah. You know, I can only tell you what I think. And it's not necessarily, obviously, it's just the way that I look at it. But we are a part of sort of the most defiant age group. Teenagers are pretty defiant people. And this time they shot at us, and that was their mistake. You don't test our age group when it comes to these things, because we will come back with a vengeance, and that's what you're seeing right now.
But Jay, in all fairness, this has happened before, and there wasn't much of a collective response like we're seeing right now.
Yes, I think another big thing is that the students at Parkland, I think, they're not common. People who can turn grief into determination and action are not common. And so I think the fact that you have leaders like that, leaders with their determination, is also something that's rare and something that plays a big role in what we're seeing here today.
Okay. Let me grab a phone call here from April from Blue Valley West High School. April, you're taking part in the rally there today?
Yes, we're actually on the campus right now. I'm one of the lead organizers for the Blue Valley District's walkout, and we're also having a rally afterwards. Right now, we're just kind of outside of the school, sitting peacefully.
How many students are taking part, April?
So, at the initial time, about 10 a.m., we had, I would say, at least 200 people out. Right now, we have about 50 to 20 because some students want to re-enter the school to finish their classes.
Yeah. How supportive has the administration there been, and how supportive are teachers to what you guys are trying to do, April?
Well, when you say supportive, I'll interpret that as, like, you know, how cooperative have they been with us?
Yes.
I think because they are a public school, they're not allowed to encourage us to go or not go at all. But being neutral and being able to provide us with a safe space to demonstrate has been really convenient for us. You know, we have had some last-minute frustrations, but overall, I think the current result, I think we're very happy with. A lot of students felt engaged. We're all encouraging each other, and it hasn't been hostile from counter-protesters.
You know, April, a lot of people think you guys are in for a long fight here. You're fighting the NRA. You're fighting a lot of money. You're fighting Republicans and some Definitely. Democrats in Congress who have been elected on the wings of NRA support and the support from people who favor gun rights.
Definitely.
To what extent are you guys in this for the long haul?
So, I gave a speech in front of my classmates, and I'll say to you what I said to them. This is a marathon, and, you know, these past few days, the March for Our Lives event, the 17-minute walkout that happened earlier in March, today, these are all the first miles of that marathon. It took things like the protesters at Kent State during the Vietnam War era. It took all of those protests, all of those movements and demonstrations to develop into, like, a counterculture. And that's, I think, what we're trying to renew here. That same type of counterculture that shows that we should not be silent just because we're younger. We're not just kids. We're kids who can vote. And I think that's really important to notice, that lawmakers really seem to be ignoring our voices because they just view us as subordinate because we're younger.
Right. April, thanks for the call. It's April from Blue Valley West High School. Good luck today, April.
Thank you.
Jay Mehta, you still there?
Yes.
I'm wondering, to what extent do you think adults are taking you guys seriously?
You know, I think a lot are. You'd be surprised at how many adults have been really excited to participate in this walkout and in the activism that's happening. But of course, there are plenty of adults who have not been. You've seen a lot of prominent figures on the other side attacking our brave fellow students at Parkland as crisis actors because they can't fathom high schoolers who are this committed and powerful. So I think there's a lot of adults that have been really supportive and an equal amount of adults who are going to take some, it's going to take some time to convince them that that we need to be taken seriously.
Lauren Washington, again from Pembroke, you're a senior there. Same question. How seriously do our adults taking what you guys are saying and what you're doing here?
Right. I agree with everything that Jay stated. You know, I think there's those handful of people who are repeating the same narrative that, you know, kids, they're just wanting to get out of school or not used to taking this protest seriously. But it's more than that. We're fed up and we want to seriously enact change and be a part of, you know, society and making change. So I think there's always going to be that few, but of the most part, I think a lot of people are just surprised and inspired by, you know, seeing the youth actually take part in something and not just be that, you know, lazy generation who, you know, sometimes they think it just wants to be on social media or stuff like that.
You know, Lauren, your generation's been quiet for a long time.
Right.
So that's why maybe some people look at you guys with a little bit of skepticism as to, are you serious this time?
Mm-hmm. Rightfully so. And so I think this is one of the big tests for our generation, and finally coming together and actually putting forth something, you know, worthwhile and amazing in our society. And so I think it's just amazing to see this culmination of groups coming together and actually proving that we can, you know, make a difference with our generation.
You know, Peter Gatto, you know, a senior from Pembroke Hill, I mean, at the root of this, are you guys a little scared by the violence you've seen around the country? Is that what's motivating, or at least part of the motivation here that's causing you guys to rally today and in previous weeks as well?
I mean, definitely. So I think that actually one of the beauties of this movement is that it's created so much unity across students. So we usually see gun control and gun rights as a very partisan issue and when we hear the news and everything, but I have many friends on both sides of the political spectrum, the liberals and conservatives, who are going to this rally because we're all students, and so this could all happen to us no matter what we think about how guns should be used outside of the classroom. So we all believe that guns just don't have a place in the classroom. And so the violence, we are scared, but it's actually making us stronger because it's giving us unity.
Caroline, you've actually had nightmares over this, if I've read correctly here.
Yeah.
Tell us about what you experienced in the wake of the Parkland shootings and how that haunted you for a while.
Well, right after the Parkland shootings, let me back up. I am a military kid, and I've lived in other places of the world, and it is not normal anywhere except for in America to have mass shootings. There was a shooting today, actually, a school shooting in Florida. One was injured. And
just this morning?
This morning, about 2 hours ago. And it's not normal. It's not normal to have people dying in mass shootings, except for in America, and that's why we're doing this, because we need that change. And I started having these nightmares right after the Parkland shooting, being like, that could be me. That could.
What was in your nightmare?
Oh, well, I'm a theater kid, and so in my nightmare, I was on the stage performing in the show that I was in at the time, and somebody came into the auditorium while I was on stage and shot some people in the auditorium, and then my friends and I ran to the drama room together, and it was horrifying.
And you had that, like, that same nightmare every other night for a while, from what I read.
Until about March 14th, which was the day that we had the first national walkout for 17 minutes. Until that day, I was having nightmares, and nobody at my school was really doing much, and so I just decided, I have to do this. We have to participate in this. This can't go on.
And that participation helped you shake that nightmare, it sounds like.
It did. As soon as I had done something about the issue, I felt better. And that has continued to go on as I've been organizing the walkout today.
Jay Mehta, again from Pembroke Hill, how much is fear driving all of this?
I think fear is driving it somewhat. I think a lot of it is fear, because as has already been said, this could easily be one of us, and we all go to school and we all deserve to feel safe. So I think there is fear involved in sort of the impetus for the movement. But I think now as momentum is picking up, it's turning into determination. And as I said earlier, the students of Parkland have been able to turn their fear and their grief into action. And that's a really powerful transformation to make. And I think we as a country are continuing to make that change. But of course, fear plays a role in it. As I said, there was a shooting again this morning. But there's no reason for us to feel safe if we keep seeing these things happen.
You know, we have a tweet here from a parent here who writes us this: the kids I know are far more than a little scared, and I, as a parent, am terrified. I shouldn't be worried when I send my kids to school. Jay, do you think, to what extent are you getting the attention of lawmakers in Washington, D.C.? Are they starting to poke their heads up and take a look at what you're all doing?
Yes, of course. Actually, at this rally today, Congressman Cleaver will be attending and speaking. We have, I think, gained a lot of attention. I think to those who have not done enough, or who have been taking money from the NRA, or have been not supporting legislation that makes our lives safer, makes our schools safer, I think this is a wake-up call, and I think a lot of them are spooked. But there's a lot of people who do support us and who are very much involved in making these rallies happen. But this is a long haul, and we shouldn't be too confident too soon. We have a lot of work to do. And I think our generation is taking this sort of mantle up, and we're going to be carrying it for the rest of our lives.
You know, I can't help but notice the passion in your voice, Jay, as you're talking to us here today. I get the sense, at least, that this is a defining moment for you, for your generation here.
Yes. And I'm going to be speaking later at the rally, and there's something that I wrote that I'll be saying to this effect. But I think every generation has a moment when they get to decide what kind of a generation they're going to be. You know, generations have had to decide, are we going to be the generation that stood by as people were enslaved? Are we going to be the generation that changed that? Are we going to be the generation that stood by as people were marginalized or oppressed in any given way? Or are we going to be the generation that changed that? And we've seen generations come to those watershed moments and come to those defining moments. And this is ours. This is our moment to decide what Generation X is going to be when you look back on this decade in 50 years or in 100 years. And I think that's incredibly important. I know personally that I finally feel like I know exactly what I need to be fighting for. And that's a really powerful moment that not all generations encounter so early.
That's interesting. Lauren, what percentage of the students at Pembroke Hill are engaged in this issue and supportive of what you guys are trying to do?
Mm-hmm. I'd say a huge majority are. There are a few who are just sticking to their beliefs and are making it more of a party issue.
Favor gun rights and feel differently than you guys do.
Yes. Yeah. But at the most part, I think everyone is still being respectful in that. A lot of us are encouraging debates about it. And, you know, our teachers are welcoming rooms to come and sit down and talk about the issue, even if you don't want to go to the rally. But I think a huge majority are, whether, like what Peter said, whether with party, whatever party you're with, they're still coming out to the rally because we're all scared and want to help find some way to stop this issue.
You know, Caroline Bennett, again, from Park Hill South High School, you're just a sophomore there. Am I just guessing correctly that organizing something like this rally that's taking place in just a few minutes in Hyde Park, it's a lot more work than maybe it appears on the surface? Am I seeing that right?
Oh, my goodness. It was so much work. And
why? Tell us about that.
The major thing about this walkout that was different than the March 14th walkout or the March for Our Lives on March 24th is that this walkout was completely led by students. Everything.
You don't want parents involved, right?
Well, I mean, parents involved is great, but this entire movement, we had a few adults help us get permits and stuff because we couldn't sign them because none of us are legally old enough.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. The rest of it was all student-led. And we've had meetings. We have a group chat where we're texting constantly. And it's a lot of work, but I think we're going to pull it off.
Good for you. We go back to some calls. Taylor from Blue Valley North. Taylor, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What's going on at Blue Valley North, Taylor?
We just finished our recognized walkout. We had over 300 students walk out onto 123rd and Lamar. Probably about a quarter of the school joined us. We had some great student speakers. We encouraged them to register to vote. And now we have about 30 students still staying out, even in the face of unexcused absences and then the consequences from them.
I was going to say, we just received a tweet from Blue Valley North saying this: all of these students are receiving unexcused absences for staying longer. Even in the face of consequences, they understand the importance of their appearance.
Yes, yes. They're a majority. It's all across the board, from freshmen to seniors. They're all here. They're holding up their signs. We have cars coming by, honking at us, supporting us, and it's phenomenal what we've seen.
Well, Taylor, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's a big day at high schools across the metro as so many students are protesting gun violence. A rally is about to take place in Hyde Park, 3619 Gillum Road in Kansas City. The students sitting in front of me are going to be joining that conversation. Jay Mehta, one of the organizers, thanks again for your time today, Jay.
Thank you very, very much.
Caroline Bennett from Park Hill South High School. Caroline, thank you.
Thank you.
And Peter Gaddo from Pembroke Hill and Lauren Washington from Pembroke. Thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics and talk about Jane Austen. Why not? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we heard from Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker about the state of violent crime in Kansas City. You can find that discussion in all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday on the show, we'll find out how UMKC's Miller Nichols Library is working to preserve Kansas City history. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Jane Austen remains a worldwide cultural phenomenon more than 200 years after her death. But what's behind that enduring popularity? Why has Jane Austen gone global in an era when interest in manners and morals, and for that matter, great literature, seem to have faded? And why does Kansas City have its own Jane Austen Society? With us today, Karen Bacon has developed and produced films and television programs for Paramount, Miramax, A&E Networks, and PBS. Karen, welcome.
Thank you very much for having us.
Beth Atwater is a Janiac, and she works at the Johnson County Public Library. Beth, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Beth, you're a real, genuine Janiac, and what does that mean exactly?
It means I'm a fangirl. it essentially means that Jane Austen has been my gateway drug into an addiction to happily ever after across most literature.
How come? Why? What is it?
It's the warm fuzzies. It's the sense of home. We talk about Jane Austen and the happily ever after and marrying for love, which are things that were new in her time and she was a pioneer in terms of fiction. But in addition to that, we think about Jane Austen being kind of the redemption of the quirky woman, the people who defied stereotypes in terms of what we today think about aristocracy. She talked about the middle class in her time in Georgian era and Regency era, which is
and
not
people didn't talk about the middle class and the lower class back in those days.
No, absolutely not. And in addition to that, you know, she's talking about people like Lizzie Bennet, who were proud women, getting a happily ever after and getting the guy that everybody is going after this in the marriage market. And, you know, she talks about women who were older than what was traditionally marriageable age and marrying a man at 29, getting to be a ship's captain's wife. That's the dream. That's what so many of us love about Jane Austen.
But still, at its foundation, a lot of romance here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Good old-fashioned romance. Yeah. Karen, what about you? What's the attraction to Jane Austen, 200 years after her death, by the way?
Well, the main thing for me is the point of view from having worked as a film and television executive, mm-hmm. and really understanding that the fascinating thing about Jane Austen is that she wrote these books 200 years ago, and people have been reading them, and they've been in print for 200 years.
It's incredible.
So it is extraordinary. And this is a woman who never had her name on her books when they were published during her lifetime.
And she went by a pseudonym, right?
No, her name was not on at all. It was just by a lady.
Because
at that time, this is the era of Sir Walter Scott. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was publishing the Waverly novels. And it's really fascinating to look at the dynamic of who was allowed to have this kind of authority in society. And women just were not there yet. And even within the circle of John Murray, where she was eventually published, she was never admitted to his salon. So while you see even Washington Irving going there and meeting Sir Walter Scott during the same era, you really don't see any women really participating at the level of a Sir Walter Scott. And so she really was the first woman to sort of penetrate this all-boys club. And finally, at the end, she was published by John Murray, and her name was put on her books at the very end after she died, on Persuasion and Northanger Abbey. But it is fascinating to look at Austen and wonder what would have happened if Austen married and didn't write any books. You know, who would have stepped in and filled that space for women? So she's very, very important to women, and I think that's really why her books are read so often, because we really see her as the one. We see her as the one who changed everything for us.
Yeah, I was going to say, Beth, is there room for men in this conversation, or is this kind of a female phenomenon?
There's absolutely room for men in the conversation. In fact, we were talking in the green room about not just women defying expectations in Austen's novels, but men defying expectations. You know, you were essentially responsible for holding on to your family's estate. You were responsible for holding on to your family's wealth, and all of that only went to the oldest son. So there were expectations that men wouldn't marry for love either. So when somebody like Darcy decides, I'm going to marry Lizzie Bennet regardless of how much money she has, he's also stepping kind of on the toe of authority, which mm-hmm. is not something that would have been expected or present at the time. So in reality, I think she talks more about social class and standing up to expectations than necessarily just women's rights or women finding a way in a world where there isn't one for them.
Are there men who take part in your Jane Austen Society meetings?
Absolutely. I will say that most of the people who are in the Jane Austen Society, as you would well expect, are women.
Yeah.
But when we talk about events, Kansas City is going to be host to the North American Jane Austen Society Convention this year. There'll be men there, not just husbands. There'll be men there.
So Kansas City is going to be host to this international conference.
It's the North American. Yep. It's going to be in Kansas City the last weekend of September.
How did we get that conference? Why is it coming here?
My understanding, and there are also other experts who would be better able to explain it, but my understanding is that it travels from city to city. This is the first time we've had it in more than 10 years, and we won't be eligible again for another 10 years because mm-hmm. they're trying to kind of spread the wealth.
Right.
But the National Society wants to make sure everybody gets access to some of these events and these conversations and keep Jane Austen's legacy alive. So Kansas City, we're a happening town. We're Paris of the Plains. Where are you asking me? We're definitely included. And our society has been working really hard to bring that to Kansas City.
So what happens at a Jane Austen conference?
Okay.
I mean, what's going to go down?
Lots of the same kind of conversations we're having now. they're going to be conversations about what life was like during her time. There'll be crafts. There'll be events. There's usually a ball at the very end. But moreover, it's just people who are extreme fans getting together to gush and really kind of feed off of one another's energy and think about all the ways that we enjoy her work.
And are there going to be events and balls and things that might be reminiscent of her time? Is that
all the things you're talking about will be there? And there is a website for the Jane Austen Society, and I'm sure they'll have additional information on it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you Janiacs out there who are listening to this, we're talking about the enduring power of Jane Austen in our society and the love for her work. 816-235-2888 is our number. Give us a shout and tell us why you like her so much. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Karen, you can't help but wonder what Jane Austen would make of all the fuss about her today, the movies that have been made, the conference that's going to be in Kansas City. I mean, what in the world would she be thinking?
Well, I really have to, maybe the audience has seen the acceptance speech of Emma Thompson when she was given the Academy Award for screenwriting in Sense and Sensibility. And I think about Emma because Emma, to me, is the reincarnation of Jane in a way. So in so many ways, I think that was Jane Austen standing up there getting that award. And I think Jane would just be crying at the ceremony and be so in awe of being given such an award. And I think she'd be very humble. And she would never really think about box office so much. She would think about having created these incredible characters and having a world appreciate what she really gave up her whole life for to create. And she's a true artist. Mm-hmm. So people always talk about, the box office and the success, and was she a business person? I think she was really one of the finest artists in our literary history of creating romantic novels. And also the characters are extraordinary. And we were just talking about even the male characters. And I think the male characters that she creates also is the reason why men are drawn to these novels. Mm. And the romance captures what it's like for a man to have to fall in love and fall in love with somebody who his parents don't want him to marry. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you have to marry this person because this is going to help our business. And in that era, the men had the same challenges as the women. It was extraordinary. It wasn't just the women, because only the eldest son would have the right or have the cultural right to inherit an estate.
Right.
And the other sons had to make a way for themselves also. And there weren't that many careers available to men also.
How many Jane Austen films, how many books did she publish in her lifetime?
She published, she started with Sense and Sensibility.
Right.
And then
that's the one most people know, right?
Well, I think that was made famous recently because of Emma Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Pride and Prejudice was the Colin Firth. Pride and Prejudice was 6 hours. So that really opened up an audience that was very helpful. I worked on that production, and the 6 hours scored the highest ratings for the whole year of A&E, and I think for a long time after. And then we did Emma. But Emma also was done with Gwyneth Paltrow. That was not our production. That was Miramax. And so that really also, I think Gwyneth was fabulous and funny. And you know, also the movie Clueless was based on Emma. So people got a chance to laugh out loud with Emma, and that was fun. So
there's been a movie made for each of her books at this point, Beth. Do I have that right?
There have been several movies made for some of them. For some of them, in fact.
Yeah.
There's been a movie made for each of them. It's almost its own. It feels like its own subgenre. I know it's not, but it feels like it's its own subgenre because it really is kind of the birth of this manners play where folks are constrained by societal expectations, but they still find a way to find their happily ever after.
How well done have the movies been, just by and large? I know you worked on some of them.
Well, that's a great question, because we were just talking about how, so the Pride and Prejudice piece that I worked on is sort of widely accepted as being the one everybody wants to watch. Colin Firth is extraordinary, Jennifer Ely, and all the actors are equally wonderfully cast, and the performances are great. And the music, the way it's filmed, it's almost sort of like Gone with the Wind with great panning scenes. And people really fall in love with the cinematic value of that piece. And then when they film them as sort of like a play, they don't do as well. And that's where I think you look at how the modern interpretation of a filmmaker can change an audience view of a novel and make it come back to life again. And make it something else, and make it something that some Janeites might not agree with us, because certainly they didn't like the scene in Pride and Prejudice when Darcy takes off his shirt and Lizzie thinks of him as sort of, you know, a nice hot number. But it helped the film, and it really helped us connect with a new audience who might not have read the novels and might not really understand that there was chemistry that came into play in romances that was unspoken. And
we're talking about Jane Austen this morning, her enduring appeal. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Jesse from Westwood. Jesse, nice to hear from you.
It's good to be on the show. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the wit and humor that Jane Austen put into all her novels, really just beyond the surface of the romance, all of the clever dialogue and jokes that she puts in on so many levels.
How long have you been reading Jane Austen books, Jesse?
Well, I'm only 19 now, but I think the first time I read Pride and Prejudice, I was 13.
Is that an early age? Is that, did many of your friends join you in reading the book at that point, or is that just you going off on your own and tackling something like that?
I think I was pretty alone at that point, but definitely by the time I finished high school, there were friends that were getting into her as much as I was.
What else do you like about the books? What captivated you so much beyond what you've already said?
I think something that really struck me, especially about Pride and Prejudice, but in several of the novels, is how they portray the romances and people changing and adapting in these relationships. Not just that, you know, Darcy rejects Lizzie at first and she's angry at him, but in the end, they both understand their faults and change because of that. Not just that someone has to get over it, you know?
So these are novels of subtlety, of depth. There's a certain deep quality to these books that really caught you.
Yes, yes. I think that's something that people maybe don't appreciate as much when people who haven't read the books or seen these films maybe just assume it's a simple romance novel, but there's a lot going on.
All right. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Good to hear from you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Gay from Liberty. Gay, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the enduring legacy of Jane Austen. Good morning.
Good morning. I adore Jane Austen, have since I was 9 years old, and I'm 64 now. So I've read her frequently over and over again. I've attended quite a few of the meetings, such as we will be having for the first time ever in Kansas City this fall. And I would like to point out that she not only formed romance novels, she formed the novel. Before Jane Austen, and in fact, her favorite author was Samuel Richardson, Sir Charles Grandison, by him, is four times longer than Pride and Prejudice. Hmm. So she took what were epics and epistolatory, in other words, they were written as letters, she turned them into the kind of speech that you can then pick up and lift and put into a movie and make really valid for listeners today, as well as readers today. The other thing I would like to add is that for everybody who thinks she's sweet and gentle, they need to get two books that there's a two volume set by Robert Rohde. They're called Bitch in a Bonnet. There are two volumes pointing out how clever and witty and ironic and sarcastic she can be.
Right. Gay, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Beth Atwater, our geniac from the Johnson County Public Library. I don't know much about Jane Austen herself, where she lived, where she's from, what her life was like. Can you fill in a few gaps here for us?
Actually, I'm going to turn that over to your other guest.
Karen.
Oh, so are you interested in knowing where she grew up?
Yeah, just tell me about her. Fill her in for me a little bit.
Well, her father was a reverend, and so Jane would have seen the entire village of her childhood come through her house in a sense that her father would have had to be interacting with a local community. So I think right there you see Jane observing many different types of people coming through her home. She was the youngest of seven children, two girls, Cassandra and Jane, never married, which was a great hardship for the family.
So Jane herself never married?
Never.
Yeah.
And neither did her sister, Cassandra. So you really see the family.
Unusual in those days, right?
It was, in a sense that that was your main goal in life, was to find security through a marriage.
Did she come close to marriage?
She really could have married someone extremely wealthy, and she felt obligated to accept the proposal at his home, which was a grand estate. And she then the next morning begged off and said, I just am not in love with you and I can't marry you. So, yeah, I mean, you do kind of sense this is somebody who had a moral compass that had a very modern take on where she thought her life should go. Because most women would have never given up that opportunity. I mean, that was a job for life, security for your family, healthcare, doctors, education, everything that a great job would have offered you in modern life. So Jane turned her back on that. And after that, things got very tough for her family. After her father died, they lost their residence at the rectory where he was a rector. And they had to go and sort of bounce around from different homes.
This is where are we talking?
So we're in Chawton. We're really in the area would be about 30 miles west of London. And the house Chawton, where she finally did reside, is now a museum. The house where she grew up is not in existence. That was either taken down or burned down. But you can see where she basically lived the last half of her life and wrote most of her novels. The house is Chawton, and it's not a small house, but it's a simple house. And she was only allowed to live in that house because her older brother was adopted by a wealthy family member, a wealthy uncle. And he inherited his estates, and Chawton was one of the cottages that was attached to this large estate, and he allowed his mother and his two sisters to live in the house. But not right away, actually.
Was Jane Austen, was she a happy person? A depressed person? Do you have any sense of her bearing?
That's such a great question. I saw in one of her biographical notes that there were 3,000 letters that she believed that she had been writing to her sister, other family members, friends, and her sister Cassandra burned.
Oh, no.
Most of them.
Oh God, you always hate to hear that. Yeah,
such
and
a loss.
And what you would pay to see those letters today?
That's why perhaps her biography has never really been done in a really glorious way, like some of the novels. But those letters would have told us, was Jane happy? So. She had remaining about 160 letters, which Cassandra must have thought were sort of whitewashed enough that they could be presented to history in 200 years later today.
But was Jane famous in her time?
Jane was famous in her time. So Emma was fabulously received because the Prince Regent had his librarian invite Jane to his library. And Jane was asked if she would put the Prince Regent's seal on her first publication of Emma. Mm-hmm. So there you have royalty knowing about Jane. So Jane would have been read in the royal circles.
And did she gain a certain measure of wealth because her books were selling, or do we know?
That's a fascinating question. Again, I don't think Jane ever really made much money. I know she made more than £100. That was not considered a lot of money, but she was paid for her books. But back then, you know, there was no copyright law. So even Charles Dickens never made a dime on any of his novels.
Is that right?
Yes. And Sir Walter Scott, he set up a system where he would publish the books and then owned a printing house so he could control the printing of his books right away. So there were many printers during that era. And once the rights to publish were sold, there was no copyright law to protect who could print the books. So printers could print thousands of copies, and Jane Austen would have no control over any kind of percentage on the sale.
Let me go back to some phone calls here. Paul from Overland Park. Paul, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. So I wanted to ask if there was any negative criticism of her works at the time and how that would have been disseminated at book reviews. I'm sure it's quite different than today. Anyway.
Thanks, Paul. Any criticism of her work that we're aware of? Yeah,
I think that's a really good question. I think that there were people who would have certainly in that circle would have thought that writing novels was inferior to writing poetry. So people don't understand poetry was like being a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. It's had the same kind of prestige. So Walter Scott's writing long poems. And if you couldn't write a poem, you know, who cares if you could write a novel? it wasn't as important. So I am not a scholar on Jane Austen. I have never seen negative reviews on her work, but I'm sure that the people of that time thought that perhaps she was inferior to Walter Scott or some of the other authors who were also poets and famous poets during their lifetimes.
Yeah.
And I don't believe she ever wrote any really serious published poetry.
You know, Beth, if you had to rank her work in terms of the book you enjoyed the most and then second and third, how do they fall for you?
For me, my favorite is Sense and Sensibility.
Mm-hmm. The first one.
Which is, yes. And then in addition to that, of course, I like Pride and Prejudice. That's everybody's. That's the one that's most common. But when I talk about her books, I can't separate that from the characters. And the character that I most love, that's closest to my heart, of course, is from Persuasion, and that's Anne Elliot. And a part of that is
Persuasion's her last book, right?
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. published posthumously. And part of that is because Anne Elliot is 29 when she finds love, and there's a part of self-identifying with her characters that kind of lets you put yourself in the shoes of this unusual woman or this woman who isn't necessarily meeting expectations. And Anne gets that redemption story in Persuasion. She gets a proposal early on and doesn't take the proposal because she's trying to do what a dutiful daughter does. You know, she gets that proposal early on with a man that she does care for and turns him down because he's not wealthy enough. He's not the right man for her family. And then later on, she gets a second chance. And, you know, we're all Americans. We all love a second chance story. So for me, Persuasion and Anne Elliot are my favorite.
I'm always fascinated by the writing process itself that these writers would have endured. And certainly Jane Austen, no computers in those days. You wonder, do we have any sense of how she put these things together?
So her father, this is also a very interesting biographical note. Her father bought her a writing box. And the box would have been able, it was portable, so she could have put it on the kitchen table. She could have put it in her drawing room. And it opened up, and there was paper and pens that she could keep and organize all of her writings. So that was extremely advanced for a father to be promoting his daughter's writing.
Mm.
And so that, I think, really is a fascinating point between a father and daughter where he was saying, I think you're good enough to be a writer, and I want to support this. And I think that, you know, here is a way I can help you. And he was not a wealthy man. And he knew that she had to get married. He could never have taken care of his children. And that's why the eldest son was allowed to be adopted by his wealthy uncle.
So she wrote longhand, obviously.
Yeah.
And as you did in those days, and just wrote it out, right?
Right.
Yeah. Imagine writing with a quill.
No, I can't. I really can't do
good
that.
Good point.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And the movie that people should see if they want to connect with Jane Austen would be what, Beth?
If you want to, my favorite, if you want to connect with Austen's work, for me, is going to be Sense and Sensibility, the Emma Thompson version that you mentioned earlier.
The film we're
the
talking
film,
about.
The yeah. film, yes. Mm-hmm. And if you are wanting to build a connection with her life, whether we're talking about the biggest biography or the smallest story, for me, it's Becoming Jane. It was a film I really enjoyed and loved, and it was about her experience in, actually the one you discussed earlier, it was about her experience and the proposal and her first love.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation with our geniacs right here on the table. That's Karen Bacon, who's developed and produced films for a whole host of networks. Beth Atwater, a geniac who works at the Johnson County Public Library. Thanks for the good conversation.
Thank
Appreciate
you for having
it very
us.
Much. You bet. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday, how UMKC's Miller Nichols Library is working to archive local history through sound recordings. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Suzanne Hogan, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.